Live from the great American Northwest, it's Pro Libertate Radio, a full throttle, no holds barred examination of the threats to life, liberty, and property. Now, here's our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Gregg.
Drop what you're doing. Greetings. Before doing anything else, we go to the phones because a fellow from Missouri by the name of Sam has been waiting with angelic restraint and heroic patience to be part of the program this evening. Sam, how are you doing?
I am doing just great, Will, and it's always good to hear your broadcast. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much. It's good to hear from you.
You bet. What I wanted to comment on, there's a couple of things that really have come to mind, and the thing I keep trying to get across to people, and I know that this shouldn't be any surprise to those of us listening to your broadcast that know what's going on, but after a while you can start to begin to predict the way things are going to go. And the other day, you know, I got to thinking, one of the interesting ironies out of this, particularly out of this BP thing, is a good example. And I kind of knew this is where it was going to wind up going, because I still see somewhere down the road they're going to use this as an opportunity to either shove the cap and trade legislation down our throat or whatever. But in the process of mulling this over in my mind, I got to thinking, I thought, isn't it interesting when it's appropriate for them to scare the daylights out of us, or try to, except for some of us that know what's going on, like last fall with this flu scare that they threw on us, which turned out to be a hoax. That was okay. But now when one of their fascist buddies is in trouble, such as in the case of BP, somehow we cover this up and the public's not supposed to know what's going on when there's a real potential for problems here.
That
is the thing that has really caught my attention out of all this. But when it benefits their pharmaceutical buddies or somebody like that, then it's okay to just scare the living hell out of the public.
They play both sides of the fear card.
Yeah.
It's really interesting. I've been thinking about exactly the same issue from sort of a different vector. I'm reading a book right now that came out about 40 years ago entitled The Day the World Ended. It was written by a couple of Brits by the name of Gordon Thomas and Max Morgan Witz, and it deals with the eruption of Mount Pelee in 1902 in Martinique in the West Indies. And I'm not going to go into the whole story here because, first of all, I'm only halfway through the book, but I'm reading it in limited doses, gritting my teeth the whole time. Because the government, the French colonial government on this island, did everything it could within its rather considerable power, ironically enough. You're dealing here with a colonial feudal system, and so they had ways of controlling access to information that the government ruling us right now doesn't enjoy, given the ubiquity of information to the internet and so forth. But they did everything they could to delay, obfuscate, and cover up the fact that this volcano was going to go. It was going to go supercritical, and it wiped out the entire capital, almost the entire populated area of Martinique when it went off. It was like an atom bomb going off. And the reason why they did this was because there was an election coming up, and if the panic had ensued and the elections had to be canceled if they were held later, the incumbent government, the so-called Progressive Party, was going to lose. They're going to be replaced by a so-called Radical Party. They're both fairly radical. The guy who was the governor of the island basically got that job because he'd been a journalist back in Imperial France, and he got his job in the so-called Republic through the Saint Simon Circle, which was a Masonic group. And so he was basically promoted by his brothers in this covert hierarchy to the position that he had. But he was willing to risk and need to sacrifice the lives of people in order to retain his political advantage during this apocalyptic crisis when this volcano was going to erupt, to the point where he actually detained the U.S. consul. He cut off the U.S. consul's access to the telegraph and detained him so the news wouldn't get out. But this is the obverse, if you will, of that fear coin that we're talking about. They want to scare us to death regarding these bugaboos and chimeras that are profitable. You bring up the swine flu, that's a perfect example. And when there's something that is a genuine disaster, the repercussions of which are going to cause some kind of political or economic injury to part of their oligarchy, they do not permit us to be frightened. As a matter of fact, they describe fear as something akin to a mental disorder or some kind of a civic crime if you're fearful about things that are actually fearsome. I mean, a few years ago when the financial sector was melting down, what were we told? Don't panic, don't panic, don't panic. And I was saying at the time, this is the perfect time to panic. Don't wait till you get permission to panic. Panic right now. Get out. You know, get out right now or you're going to be wiped out. And they were doing that because they wanted people to stay in until they were able to fix the platinum parachutes for all the wired-in oligarchs on Wall Street. And then, of course, they wanted to be able to put in the fix to where we're indemnifying everything that these people did during the most recent boom. Same thing's going on with BP, and it's the same mindset, albeit in a much more extreme fashion that we saw here in Martinique. We literally had hundreds of people immolated or suffocated under this cascade of volcanic ash that could have been saved if the government had been willing, the people running that government, had been willing to tell them the truth or let them merely find out the truth about what's going on. These people could have gotten on boats and gotten off the island.
Well,
but I think that's the same mindset.
One of the things that really concerns me, and I have to go back to what you were saying a while ago about the potential backlash here, because I'm going to tell you, I served on our city council here where I live. I served for 2 years.
How big is Owensville? Forgive me for interrupting.
Owensville is a town of 2,500 people. And this is normally what you would consider, for the most part, a pretty conservative town. In fact, if you want to go by that paradigm, okay, now you can't hardly tell anymore, but... But I'll just give you a good case in point. Now, back in the 90s when Bill Clinton was in power, he was the one that got us in under the Agenda 21 paradigm, in which the government's been going in doing these large land grabs and all these all these UN international treaties and all this kind of stuff. Well, when I was on a city council, it was interesting watching how this agenda filtered down amongst people who would claim to be conservative, and they didn't even know it. I mean, and you try to enlighten them on it, and it's amazing how the brainwashing worked, because we had, one of the things we had last October that made me so mad, I got it from the table shaking all over, I was so mad. We had a guy come in there who was under the guise of updating the planning and zoning books. And don't get me started on planning and zoning, that's a whole other...
Yeah.
Don't get me started on that one. But anyway, so this guy claimed to be coming in to update the planning and zoning books. Well, the first thing that made me aggravated, because I didn't know anything about it, you know, as a city alderman at the time. But what really made me mad was this guy was the same one. You remember the tragedy that happened over in Kirkwood, Missouri? I'm sure you probably covered that, knowing all the connections you have in journalism, okay? So you know basically what happened over there. You had a guy who was basically back against a wall that lived there all of his life trying to run a business, and when they started adopting all the new codes and ordinances, they were harassing him, and he finally got mad, and you know what he did. Well,
yeah, it was terrible. I wrote about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this guy that they had in there was the same one that planned Kirkwood. And he goes through about a quarter of his speech, and I stopped him, and I said, what I hear you promoting is the Agenda 21 program, and it got deathly quiet for about 30 seconds. And then he came back and he said, well, yeah, it's Agenda 21, but it's not the UN Agenda 21. This is a different Agenda 21.
Really?
Yeah. And I said, well, first of all, you know, you can't kid a kidder, okay? I mean, I know better than that. So anyway, but the thing that really got me is one person on the Planning and Zoning Board talking about sacrifices we have to make for the greater good. That greater good, every time I hear that sends chills down my spine, because you know the person, first of all, doesn't even have a clue of what it means, but secondly,
exactly,
they're very easily persuadable into things that they shouldn't be into. But anyway, the thing that pushed me over the edge with this guy was he was going along and he said, does Owensville have a water district? And I said, no, and several others said no. And he goes, shame on you for not having a water district. He said, when you turn on the tap, you have to have water. When you flush the toilet, you have to have water. What a better way to control the people out in the county
to conform
to your codes and ordinances by controlling the water out in the county. And that made me mad because being the kind of guy that I am.
He actually said that?
Yeah.
Talk about somebody being tone deaf to what he's saying.
Yeah, I know. Now, fortunately enough, we just don't have the means to have that out here. I mean, for our town to ever do something like that, we'd have to upgrade our pumps from 220-volt pumps to 440-volt pumps and upgrade all the mains and everything else, so I don't see how it could ever happen. But it's just the idea that it was even suggested made me, I was so mad when I got up from that table. I'll tell you, that's probably one of the worst experiences I ever had in serving on city government when that happened.
Well, you know what they say out here in the West, whiskey's for drinking, water's for fighting. And what you were talking about here with respect to this Agenda 21 spawned water grab is typical of what's happening throughout the West and the Midwest. Hey, Sam, can you hold through the break?
You bet. I'd be glad to.
Okay, great. I'd like to hear more about this because it's very informative and perfectly infuriating. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. 866-986-6397 is our call-in number, and we'll be right back. Well, we're talking with Sam from Owensville, Missouri, about, among other things, the way that the UN's Agenda 21 plan for centralized control over the biosphere, that means pretty much everything, folks, filters down even to the level of a city council in the idyllic hamlet of Owensville, Missouri, population 2,500. And these people who are satisfied that they're conservatives, that they're independent-minded, find themselves repeating the nostrums of basically collectivist globalism when they're talking about sacrifices for the greater good and creating a water district as a way of controlling people because you would control access to the tap that they would have to use for their household needs. Am I more or less summarizing your experience there, Sam?
Yeah, absolutely, and I think I'm going to sum it up this way, Will. And this, the reason I even bring this up is because it's amazing how people are so hyper suggestible, and that's what scares me more than anything else. And this is a prime example. But Trish and I happen to be up at a local beauty operator's place here to get our hair cut, and we got she was going to get her hair cut. I cut mine. I have what I call Sam's Hillbilly Barbershop over here. We only have one customer. It's in the basement, and it opens for 29 minutes, and I'm gone. And so that's the way we cut hair here. But I don't think Trish wants me to do it that way, my wife. I think. But anyway, to make a long story short, so I took her up there, and we're talking to these people in there, and I said, you know, if you stop to think about it, I said, you know, we're already slaves in this country. And they, right away, they got thinking about it. I said, what happens if you don't pay your city taxes? I said, just think about it already. I said, what happens if you don't pay your real estate taxes? I said, you've bought the property, you've cleared all the payments, but yet they can still come and get it if you don't pay the taxes. I said,
or
what happens
if
you
don't
pay
your
bills?
Yeah, I was just going to say, if you don't pay your bills, if you don't pay a municipal water bill, what will happen is they'll put a tax lien on your home. That tax lien will be bundled and sold to investors, and next thing you know, the county sheriff's going to be knocking on your door with a deed of possession that is being executed on behalf of somebody who bought that lien because you didn't pay a water bill, you didn't pay a traffic fine, in spite of the fact that you paid your real estate tax. By the way, property taxes are such an abomination. If you own something, you shouldn't pay taxes on it. You paid your taxes, your income taxes, your property taxes, you may have paid off the mortgage, but if they can dig up this lien, they can take your home out from under you. I wrote about that a couple of weeks ago. It's perfectly infuriating. It's going on more often than most people would think.
Well, that's
and
right. And
that
another thing that people need to look into, and I've tried my best to get this across to people, Will, if you read through the International Property Maintenance Code, which is part of this International Code Council's Agenda 21 program, under that code, you don't have any choice as to whether you want to be on the utility grid or not. They state in that code that your property has to be tied to an approved code utility, so which means that what happens if you don't pay the bill? Well, even if you decide, well, hey, I can make it with no lights, it doesn't matter. If you decide that, hey, I'm just going to tough it out rather than pay these outrageous electric bills, guess what? They can come and condemn your property because, well, even though they shut off the electric service, you're not on an approved international code utility. So see, this is where we're moving to, and the thing I'm trying to get across to people, and I said this even back when I was on the city council, and now I see it starting to come to pass with articles that I see coming up in the news. I said, first of all, it's your property now, such as your homes and businesses they're coming after now, and the city can tell you more what you can do with it. City government and feds and everything else now are trying to tell you more what you can do with it than you're allowed to do with it yourself. I said, it's that now. Next, it's going to be your own body. And what happens? We start seeing mm-hmm. threats of forced vaccination. We start seeing threats of various other things that they want to do. Now we have the introduction of international health care if this keeps going. It's not hard to predict where these people are going. And it makes me mad because, well, I'm going to tell you something. I'm a blind person. If I can see it, what the heck's wrong with all these other people?
Well, it's one of those things that the prophet Isaiah talked about. You know, give them eyes that don't see and ears that don't hear, lest they see with their eyes and hear with their ears and repent and be healed. It seems as if that's sort of the situation we're in right now when you're dealing with this all-encompassing assault on the very idea of property. And at the risk of sounding sacrilegious, I suppose, I have to lay at least part of the blame at the feet of that faction of our founding fathers who were Hamiltonian in their outlook, because I hold them responsible for disfiguring the Bill of Rights with that cute language at the bottom of Amendment 5 that deal with what is now called eminent domain.
Yes.
The idea that government can take property for a public purpose. And that, of course, is something that is more candidly described in countries like Australia, for instance, and Singapore, where they talk about involuntary seizure. They talk about involuntary seizure of property or involuntary control of property on the part of the government. They don't use this locution eminent domain, which sounds vaguely unsettling but somewhat mystifying. But the premise behind eminent domain, quite frankly, is that the government allows us to keep what property we think we own as a gift of grace by the state, and that's subject to revocation when there are sacrifices that have to be made in the interest of the greater good. Ah, that utilitarian formula that can justify any crime against anybody. And Sam, I don't know if this is something you've thought about, but I've been involved in a book project over the last couple of years. It's one of those things that never die. Dealing with cultural and linguistic communism, the way that people's perceptions are reset through language. And you talk about the idea that people put in practice and in play in conversations at city council meetings and such like, these ideas rooted in altruism and rooted in utilitarianism, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, which is one of the most horrible things ever said in one of my favorite television programs. And of course, they eventually went back and corrected that, but that's one of the more memorable axioms to come out of Star Trek, and it's a perfectly horrible idea. That's the fundamental utilitarian formula. But I've gotten to the point where anytime I hear somebody talk about the common good or the idea of making sacrifices in the public interest, or even when I hear the word community in a mental sense, I let the safety catch off my pistol. Because chances are they're invoking that language to justify taking something from me or from other innocent people by force that they're not entitled to. And I don't see how we're going to solve this problem unless we can get people to start using language that's not so freighted with these bad collectivist assumptions. And that's one of the reasons I think why you run into people even at a city council meeting who seem to have been reprogrammed, is that the language that they're using has literally reconstituted the way that they think. And without even knowing it, they have been caught in the collectivist undertow, and now they're reciting things that lead to the denial of property and all the horrible things that come in this train.
Well, you know what's so scary about this, Will, is I can guarantee you, and it's probably the same way where you live as well, and I don't mean this to sound braggadocious, because God knows anybody can learn if they take the time. I mean, my wife and I have been doing research, and we even do our own broadcast, and we've been doing it for years now. And if anybody can do it, you know, if we can do it, anybody can do it, okay? Uh-huh. But the average person on your city council doesn't know hardly anything about the stuff they need to know about what's going on. In fact, particularly on your planning and zoning boards, most of the people know less that serve on planning and zoning boards and on code councils than the rest of the public just trying to make it at large. I mean, it's bad.
Yeah.
I mean, the stupidity level is horrible, and I don't mean that in a condescending way. I'm not trying to brag and make it sound like I'm the smartest cookie in the drawer. But I'm going to tell you something. I didn't even go to college. Well, and if I can figure this out...
Well, that's why you do so much better.
You're probably right. The fact that I didn't go to college is why I still have some sanity left.
I think you're exactly right. Look, Sam, thanks so much for calling in.
You bet.
It's always a blessing to hear from you.
You betcha.
Stay safe and enjoy Missouri, which is a lovely place anyway. If
yes.
not for the existence of the political class, I think every place in this country would be lovely. This is Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network, 866-986-6397. We'll be back at you in just a minute or two, so stick around.
System memory crash.
Now, back to our host, author, lecturer, and investigative journalist, William Norman Grigg.
In just 8 years, this city sprang from the desert almost spontaneously, where once there was a railroad crossing, a Dairy Queen, and about 1,000 people. There are now 33,000 residents in what has become a bedroom community for Phoenix, a 40-mile drive northeast across the desert. I have to interject that this article, which is entitled Poster Child for the Housing Crisis, quote, "They Were Building Mortgages in Arizona Town," was published almost exactly 2 years ago. But this is intensely relevant for reasons I will describe anon. Maricopa, that's the name of the town. It's not Maricopa County. I don't want to confuse you unduly. Maricopa is a county in Arizona, and 40 miles south of Phoenix, there is a town called Maricopa that sprung up over the last decade. Maricopa was built so quickly that it does not have a hospital or a movie theater. It has nice new schools, but the only restaurants are chains such as Taco Bell and Panda Express, neither of which, I interject, could be called a restaurant. Still, this was the place where young people and first-timers could live the dream of owning a home. In Phoenix, they used to say, drive until you can afford it. And Maricopa is where buyers ended up. Built on low interest, interest only, and adjustable rate mortgages. Let me stop right there. Oh, boy. Why do we prosecute people who deal in drugs when people who dealt in adjustable rate mortgages and teaser rates and other narcotized financial products are allowed to walk the streets freely? I really don't think, as bad as narcotics are, once again, to reiterate my position, I don't think the government has any kind of authority to regulate what somebody chooses to ingest. But that doesn't mean that I think narcotics are a good thing. Narcotics are a very bad thing. Most pharmaceuticals are very bad things as well. But narcotics do not do the damage that these financial products do and continue to do. I mean, we are going to collapse as a society, as an economy, because of the narcotic addiction to debt that the Federal Reserve created and propagated and continues to peddle even today. To go back to the story, this, by the way, was from ABC News, once again, May 7, 2008. Built on low interest, interest only, and adjustable rate mortgages, Maricopa inflated along with the real estate market across the country. But today, with many front yards overgrown by weeds, decorated with short sale and bank-owned real estate signs, Maricopa has been described by some real estate analysts as the poster child for excess in the housing market. Back in 2005, quote, "If I listed a home, I would have two or three offers on it within the same day," real estate broker Susan Abdallah said. Oh, by the way, I have a brother-in-law who did exactly the same thing. As a matter of fact, I have a brother who's done exactly the same thing. They both went in to the real estate market as realtors about, we think, four or five years ago. They were flipping houses. In the case of my brother-in-law, he had obtained a property for a pittance, on credit. He actually, let me share a little bit more about this particular case. He owned a ranch outright that he sold in order to capitalize his real estate business, which was based on speculation. So he took the money that he got in exchange for a wonderful ranch in rural Nevada, and he started buying houses. And he would start fixing them up, doing rudimentary, preliminary yard work and maintenance. He didn't know anything about painting or renovating a home, but that didn't stop him, just as it didn't stop millions of others from doing the same thing. But on some occasions, he'd put out a for sale sign and start mowing the lawn, and before he'd get the lawn mowed, somebody would come up and make an offer on the house. That's the way people behave at the tail end of a real estate boom, and that's a good sign that the boom is about to go bust, when people start behaving in that type of irrational fashion. To continue now. On a recent day, she showed a home that's real estate broker Susan Abdallah here from Maricopa, the city in Arizona, which originally sold for $225,000 that had been repossessed by the bank after reducing the price to $105,000. That's, of course, less than half of what it had sold for. She still had no offers and was preparing to put the house up for auction. Abdallah has 60 bank-owned properties to sell. This is 2 years ago, people. It's not gotten any better since then. As many as 1 in 10 houses in Maricopa are for sale, even while new houses continue to be built. Homeowners, banks, and builders are all competing to sell at ever lower prices, which, by the way, would be a good thing if anybody had any money. You see, that's the definition of a depression, is a system-wide contraction in an economy that results in a general decline in price levels. That's a good thing. What makes a depression bad is the effort by government to prevent this from happening by continuing to pump liquidity into a market, preventing the liquidation of overpriced goods and the liquidation of overbuilt assets. That's what makes a depression bad. A depression, of course, is always going to be painful. What turns into a catastrophe is the miracle of government intervention. Many people blame the bubble and bust on investors, both amateur and professional, who speculated in new homes. The difference between an amateur and a professional speculator is that a professional speculates with somebody else's money. That's the only difference between the two of them. It's not a question of what they know or whether they're successful. They're all unsuccessful. The difference is that a professional manages to put somebody else's money up, and an amateur is somebody who loses his own money. The professional, of course, manages to take his cut before he loses somebody else's money. I think that was part of the mistake, and that the builders made was that they allowed investors to come in and buy, Abdallah said, allowed them to buy tracts of homes, you know, 5, 6, 10 houses, and they bought them on speculation. Once again, this is the behavior that one finds at the end of a real estate bubble, or a bubble of any kind. Mayor Kelly Anderson, who grew up in Maricopa, said, "You had builders and other development people that could not get permits fast enough. They wanted a permit turned around in 12 hours because they couldn't sell the home fast enough. They had people lined up 100 deep on a Sunday morning for a lottery ticket." That is to say, a ticket to buy a home. They were actually to the point where they were having lotteries to decide who'd have the chance to borrow money and go hopelessly in debt in order to buy a home that they were going to lose to the bank within 4 or 5 years. This is your economy on drugs, specifically narcotized credit. Prices rocketed, promising quick profits for speculators and many individual buyers who really couldn't afford the house they bought. By early 2004, the median resale price of a house was about $150,000. 2 years later, it was nearly $260,000. Then the mortgage crisis hit, and by the end of 2007, that resale price had plummeted to just more than $197,000, and brand new houses were even less, about $180,000. Many owners faced with increasing interest rates were unable to pay their mortgages and unable to refinance because their houses were worth less than they had paid for them. That's very commonplace, and that's something that is going to continue to become commonplace. It's going to become increasingly commonplace in our economy. People started to lose homes or turn their keys in and walk away. That is to say, they're practicing strategic default. Jay Butler, who teaches real estate at Arizona State University, said to the builders, quote, "This is key. This is really the poll quote, the takeaway from this article. Once again, I'll start the sentence anew. Jay Butler, who teaches real estate at Arizona State University, said of the builders, quote, "They really weren't building homes. They were building mortgages that they could put into mortgage-backed securities in order to sell them to investors in China and France." Now, think about this for a second. You have a stretch of desert property, 40 minutes south, of Phoenix in Arizona. The one railroad track, there was a little settlement out there. It had been there for a long, long time. People who were born and lived there for whatever reason worked somewhere else. It wasn't a city. It was just a little place on the map. The Federal Reserve engineers this huge boom in the real estate and mortgage market by reducing the lending rates to concessionary levels. This money flows out of what we're told to call money, this fiat money, rolls out as a tide across the countryside, and some of it pools in this little area that's now called Maricopa. People want to make a profit off of this fiat money, this liquidity. The way you're going to do that is by getting people into debt and then repackaging that debt into securitized instruments that are sold to investors in other countries. So the people who generate the debt profit off the debt, investors end up profiting on the debt, and they're indemnified by taxpayers, and the city arises and falls within 4 or 5 years, and the people in the middle of this transaction are laid waste. We'll talk a little bit more about this on the other side of the break. Will Grigg, Pro Libertate Radio on the Liberty News Radio Network. We'll be back in just a minute. So what happened here in this little town called Maricopa, Arizona, not to be confused with Maricopa County, which is not little, nor is the town. Discuss. Sorry. Just coffee talk. Maricopa was not a town 10 years ago. It was a spot on the map. It had a railroad stop, or actually didn't even have a stop. I mean, they didn't have a railroad station there. There was a railroad that went through this little intersection in the middle of nowhere. Some people live there. Most of them work someplace else. But suddenly, starting in about 2000, 2001, when the Federal Reserve went absolutely hyperinflationary, almost. I mean, it's not hyperinflationary in terms of the prices, but it was. This is something that's very important to recognize. You can have targeted hyperinflation. That's what happens in a housing bubble of the sort that we saw. This, of course, came off the heels of the bursting of the dot-com bubble when anybody who could put together a web address was able to attract investment or put out an IPO just on the basis of putting .com, .org, or .net behind the name of whatever passing transitory notion he would commit to paper. But the bubble began to be inflated in the real estate market in the latter part of the 1990s, nearly part of the first decade of this century. And Maricopa was one of these places where this flood tide of liquidity pooled, and suddenly you had a community of 33,000 or 40,000 people spring up in a matter of years. This is the sort of thing that happened in the late 19th century when you had the Homestead Act and the outgrowth of some of the subsequent measures to open up the Western frontier. Of course, you also had the expropriation of the people whose land was being opened up for settlement. You'd send the army in to drive them off after they had been promised in the case of the Lakota Sioux or the Poncas in the upper Midwest. They'd been promised their lands in perpetuity, which meant until we find something useful, you can live here. And when something useful was found, the settlers would show up and the army would show up and say, in the words of Darth Vader, "I have altered the bargain. Pray I don't alter it further." And that means that these people were rounded up and sent to desolate territories in Oklahoma, for the most part, simply to die. But you had people making bad investments in the late 19th century as well and end up in a situation where they were hopelessly in hock to Eastern Seaboard banking interests who had more or less a monopoly on the actual currency, the specie, the gold that backed our currency at the time. That's one of the reasons why you had the populist movement demand the free coinage of silver. They wanted an inflationary coinage of silver to expand the money supply so that these people could start paying off the loans that were killing them, because the land that they had been given at concessionary prices proved to be infertile and not particularly useful. And that led to some interesting permutations of populist politics that by and by inflicted the Federal Reserve System on us. It's really interesting how that happened. I don't have time to get in the story. It's sort of confusing and not terribly germane to this discussion, beyond saying that people end up making bad economic decisions because they're manipulated into them by people who control the banking system. And that's what happened in Maricopa, this town in Arizona. The reason why this town sprung up was that it was serving as a pass-through. There were people who wanted to build mortgages. Building homes was incidental to this process. The good of first intent for the people who were involved as investors here was to get people in debt, because the debt could be securitized and the debt could be vended in the international financial markets to investors overseas. The story here from ABC News specifically mentions a couple of those destinations. Once again, here is the key quote, the summum bonum, if you will, of this article. We're quoting from Jay Butler, who is an eminently quotable associate professor of real estate at Arizona State University. I don't know why he's a full professor. Doesn't mention the fact that he's not a full professor in the story. He should be. I really wish he were. He's the one, by the way, who recently did a tremendously valuable study on strategic defaults, which is also not mentioned in this article. Strategic defaults, of course, means giving jingle mail to your bank, to your mortgage lender, and that's something that people are doing right now because it's in their economic best interest to do so. And we're supposed to be scandalized by this. It's not a good thing to do, don't get me wrong. It's not something that I think is a good thing. If you're in a situation where it may be the only thing you can do, I don't think it's the worst thing you can do. But we shouldn't be looking down our proverbial collective nose at people who do this, when the people who made a killing off of these bad debts in the casino corporatist capitalism of the last couple of decades have us on the hook to indemnify their stupid decisions. Those people have no right to condemn folks who are upside down on inflated mortgages. Now that the bubble has burst, they owe more on their homes than they can get for them, and they find themselves in a position where they can't make the payments and they're going to lose their home. I see nothing at all wrong with cutting your losses and starting over in a rental somewhere until you can get yourself in better fiscal shape. To continue now from this article, Jay Butler of Arizona State University said to the builders they weren't really building homes. They were building mortgages that could be put into mortgage-backed securities in order to sell them to investors in China and France. Now, once that deal was done, Maricopa ceased to be important. So they got their bit at the front end here by securitizing at an inflated rate all these bad mortgages and then getting what they could out of investors overseas. And then the bubble collapsed, the housing market went into a tailspin, people started to lose their homes, but the investors who made those deals are knee-deep in donuts and whores as we speak. People are forced to leave nearly every day, continues ABC News. Stuck in the middle are families like Brad and Sarah Milnes and their infant daughter, Hannah. They recently bought a new house in Phoenix, but they have been unable to sell their home in Maricopa. Oh, boy. I know, and I'm sure that many of you do as well, at least a half dozen people are in exactly that same kind of predicament. They have to leave. They can't unload their home, but they have to buy another home. Suddenly, they're saddled with two mortgages that they can't pay. I can think of at least a half a dozen people I know who have been in that situation, been put in that situation recently because of economic issues, not employment issues. That's often the case when somebody has to move. He has to keep his home while he buys another one. This isn't what I'm talking about. I'm talking about people who had to leave a home they couldn't afford and then yet buying another home they can't afford, and suddenly they're stuck with these two mortgages simultaneously. Brad, who used to sell houses here in the days when they sold themselves, has been laid off for lack of business. We don't want to give this house back for $100,000 less than we paid for it, Milnes said. but plenty of people have done just that. He has seen former customers and neighbors just disappear. Civic leaders are worried that Maricopa will have the reputation of a ghost town with tumbleweeds blowing down Main Street. I think that's a good bet, by the way. Thousands of people still live here and go to the schools. But Maricopa's promise has been delayed, possibly by years. Maricopa is still a great place to build, said Mayor Anderson. It's a great place to live, work, play, and learn. And right now, concludes ABC, houses are really, really cheap. They're going to get cheaper still. And once again, this would be a really good thing if people had the money to take advantage of it. And you know what? We're not going to have the money to take advantage of it, because the only way that you can generate real wealth is by producing things. And right now, the government, enthralled to the evil axioms of the Keynesian heresy, is consuming everything. It is rolling up unfathomable amounts of debt. The largest debt issue in the history of the United States just took place a couple of weeks ago. And that's not going to stop. Now, when the government is doing this, it crowds out any capital that could be used for private investment. So even if you have people who are willing to expand, and right now, in the face of this contraction, this economic contraction, most people are not worried about expansion. They're worried about survival. That's why the S&P 500, if you take a look at the people who are running the S&P 500 right now, these are the non-financials. These are the people who actually build things or offer services. They're sitting on $1.3 trillion on their cumulative balance sheets. And they're being accused of hoarding cash, sabotaging the economic recovery because they're not willing to spend. You know why they're not willing to spend? They don't know what this demented government is going to be doing to the economy. Many of them are facing oblivion in a couple of years because of the Obamacare mandates that are going to put them out of business. They look at the tax and regulatory system that's being foisted on us right now, an even worse one that we've been living under for decades. They think we'd better keep as much of our operating capital as we can, because if we're going to survive this, we're going to have to be cash rich. And that's a good rule of thumb for a depression. But while people are trying to keep what they have, the government is stealing the value of what we have through inflation. And they're crowding out any prospect of economic recovery, because if it's going to happen, it's going to be done by government intervention. That's what Keynes proclaimed. So let it be written, so let it be done at whatever expense to our economy and our future. And that future, I think, is foreshadowed in this terrible story of the tiny town of Maricopa, Arizona. Thanks for joining me this week. Please join me online at freedominourtime.blogspot.com. For Pro Libertate the blog, be advised that there is a PayPal button there if you have the means and inclination to donate. That's pretty much how I'm supporting my family right now, and I do appreciate your help. I'll be back in a week, and until then, as always, Dum Spirito Pugno, while I breathe, I fight. Good night, good luck, God bless, and have a wonderful Lord's Day tomorrow.